Station 2 Science Night. Please stand by.
Welcome back to another edition of the Science Night podcast. My name, it's James. And with me as always is Steffi.
Hey.
And Jason.
Hello.
Tonight we got so much to talk about. There was a total eclipse of the sun, and of course we're going to talk about that because it was science and we got a comet. But we also got some strange milk, and in the second half we're talking about a new Stellarator strategy. There's so much to talk about now, so let's get into it. I think before we get started, we gotta look at some listener mail that came in. So Jason, what did you just come across on your Facebook feed?
In sixth grade, my best friend Rob moved away. He moved to Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And ended up going to Penn State for college. And, you know, we stayed in touch all these years. But, you know, like, we were really, really close, right? And it was devastating at the end of sixth grade to lose my best friend, right? But I'm grateful that I still keep in touch with him. And when he was at Penn State, he fell in love with a woman from Australia. And so he's been living in Melbourne for like 25 years now.
Oh, wow.
And so I have only seen him one time in probably 35 years. And that was just randomly. He was in D.C. when we lived in Baltimore, and we drove to D.C. to go see him. But we do keep in touch. And he told me that he was listening to the podcast, and he told me he was going to listen to every episode, right? And I was like, oh, that's really sweet. But I got this message from him the other day that says, I've really been enjoying Science Night. I haven't listened to all of them like I said I would, but it is in my podcast rotation. There is something very strange about listening to you, though. I think I remember your voice before you went through puberty, and it's weird hearing you with a man's voice. But the way you speak is familiar, just an octave or two lower than I remember, and more educated sounding. Keep up the good work. That made my day. I loved it.
That was the
best thing ever.
Can he put that on Apple like podcast reviews?
Yeah.
Yes, can we? Maybe.
The whole thing. Just cut and paste. He can just cut and paste that.
Oh, for sure. That's funny.
Okay.
That's funny stuff. I hope he listens. You probably want to snap again. I talked right over that.
No, it's okay. Oh, that's right. Through on mine.
You can separate them. I forgot.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I
loved that message. Thank you, Rob.
That's really cute.
Well, if you want to send in your listener mail, we got a Gmail on our website. Just click on that little envelope and it'll get you right to our Gmail. You can even send a comment right onto the website or send something to any of us on social media. The moon was like, I don't got enough play. I'm going to jump in front of the sun for a little bit and you're all going to have to deal with it. And of course we all looked up, hopefully wearing appropriate eye protection. So how was everyone's solar eclipse viewing experience?
I think I was the furthest away from like totality. So we only had 86%, I think. I dismissed my class early and told them to go outside. I'm in Wisconsin. Nice. Everyone else was outside. It was a clear day. Not everyone had eye protection, but we did take out the control room disco ball outside.
Ooh,
so you could see a bunch of tiny little crescents on the ground. So that was
awesome.
Fun. Yeah.
Nice. So you made a fabulous version of a camera obscura.
Yeah, right.
Is what you're saying.
Exactly.
I love it.
And I'm guessing every control room in science has a disco ball, right?
Yeah, I was going to say something about that, but then I just was thinking about how cool it was that you got to use it for this application.
Right?
And suddenly I realized that right there justifies the use of grant money. I'm just kidding.
That's true. Yeah.
No, I
honestly
purchased disco ball and I donated the disco ball
to science.
But I think that every NSF grant should have a checkbox. Does your lab include a disco ball?
Well,
if the answer is no, it just immediately gets shut down. You can't fill out the rest of it. That's like question two.
As a way to safeguard the taxpayer dollars, I think you need a follow-up question, right? Does your laboratory have a disco ball? And then The second one is, does this research proposal involve disco ball usage?
Exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it doesn't, and also the lab doesn't have a disco ball, it's really not the American taxpayer's responsibility to buy that disco ball until
sure.
the research moves in a direction where that disco ball is necessary for the laboratory.
I guess I would have a counterpoint. And in what world is a disco ball not necessary
right?
to research?
Well, that's more of a philosophical question.
Sure.
Right? And so, you know, that takes us to the various... schools of thought in terms of the knowledge of doing science, right? The epistemology of science, really. And so, you know, you've got multiple schools of thought. First, you've got the Russians, of course, and they're really, really heavy on the, like, strategy, right? So the strategy of science. Then you've got the Swedish, right? And they're really into, like, the disco mm-hmm. strategy, right? Mm-hmm. That's why they had, you know, palindromic music artists and, all these things that have to do with math and disco. This is going nowhere, and neither one of you is even contributing to this, and I don't know where to go with it anymore.
I was just waiting to
I'm
see
not,
where you
I'm
were
not
going.
I'm going to interrupt, Art. Yeah.
I don't know how yes. to land this plane, James. I'm sorry.
Yes, and you can see it come together in, like, Central Europe, where it's very engineering heavy, very science. I'm thinking about, like, the German tradition of science, where
meticulous.
They take a little bit from, very meticulous,
yeah.
but also very disco heavy.
Right. Very disco heavy. Also, like, the angles of the mirrors on the disco ball are more precise than anywhere else in the world, right?
That's
that
true.
Precision,
that's true.
That attention to detail. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Steffi, I would argue that your disco ball that was probably not German engineered
was
not giving you the full 88%. It was probably somewhere between like a 92 and a 75%
yep.
in your crescent moons, where if you had a German engineered, like, ready for Autobahn speed disco ball,
yep.
You would see that 86% portrayed onto the ground.
Yeah, good point.
Yep.
Because you didn't have the precise German engineering there, you probably had a lot of, you know, proverbial potholes on your disco
yeah.
ball, right? Which would not be appropriate for the Autobahn.
Right. I mean, there's several things that the United States could take away from Europe. One is light rail. I think we really missed the mark by not including light rail and heavy rail for that case into the American transportation schema, but also precision disco balls. I feel like that's really held us back, scientifically, economically, grammatically even. So
just like the eclipse,
yeah. you know, maybe as a science envoy, Steffi, you could get in on that. Hey, was anyone prepared for the temperature to just like drop 10 degrees without a whole lot of warning? I wasn't. I know why.
Were you in totality?
No, I was at 98%
okay.
in totality.
So I was at 98% in 2017, right? And just like you, Steffi,
I was like
classes.
100. Yeah.
Right.
I just skipped. I skipped. Like, I went to, in 2017, we had a science festival. So we all left. We took the science trailers.
Yeah.
And then had an eclipse festival. And it was amazing.
Yeah, right. So in 2017, I was stuck on campus instead because we weren't in totality, right? And so, and I had to teach. And so the experience of, like, you know, I think we were like 98% James last time, right? Not the same as what it was this time, right? And
sure.
this time for me, it was in totality. Our classes were canceled. NASA was at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Wow.
It was a big deal. It was a beautiful day. We sat in my backyard
right.
and just made a fire in the fire pit and played all afternoon outside until it was time to watch the eclipse, right? And the temperature drop, right? So I remember, the reason I bring this up, James, I remember the temperature drop when we were at like 98%. I was like, oh, wow, that's cool. Like, it's, you know, temperature's dropping. That's neat, right? It was nothing compared to like what it felt like when it was totally dark.
Yeah,
right?
It's wild.
And it was awesome. It was one of the strangest feelings, right? And what I guess to me, what was the most strange about it was that as it became darker, the angle of the light looked one way. And so it was like trippy mm-hmm. looking in one direction. And as the light returned, it was trippy in the other direction. It felt like, you know, the light was coming in from a different way now. It gave me a lot of vibes like Natural Born Killers. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you know those scenes, right? Where they're on mushrooms?
No.
So like, I
gotcha.
Only know of mushroom use from that movie, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case my children are listening. That was kind of the feeling. It felt very trippy, like, you know, someone had eaten a bunch of mushrooms. I guess what I'm trying to say is I see why people chase these. I really do.
Yeah.
I see it.
Sure.
I understand it entirely. I understand why these events have had such an overwhelming impact, I guess is what I'm trying to say, on human societies and cultures and civilizations through time, right? I get mm-hmm. it. I understand it. I want to go chase the next one.
And you got to be at home, too.
And I got to be at home. Right? I never left my house yesterday, which was awesome, right?
When the weather models were getting to the accurate stage,
yeah.
like 10 days out and everything, Indianapolis was being identified as like, hey, this is the place to be because yeah. there's not going to be any clouds and it's right like on the totality line.
Yeah, it was amazing. So we had like over 3.5 minutes of totality.
Wow.
Yeah.
Northern New England, near where I call home, was also in one of those areas because there was like a big band of weather going through like the Mid-Atlantic
and
the Great Lakes and everything. While we only saw about 98% totality, if we would have driven like an hour north, kind of close to the Canadian border in Vermont or into Montreal or to Quebec, if we wanted to make it an international incident, we would have been like right in the path of totality. And boy, were there a lot of people from Connecticut and Massachusetts on the highway yesterday, which is even worse because there's people from Connecticut and Massachusetts in the highway, which is always a dangerous thing.
Yeah. I had a friend yesterday from Chicago who I didn't know was in town. They came down to Indianapolis to, you know, meet up with some other people and see the eclipse. And it took them 8 hours to get home to Chicago. Mm-hmm. After that, right? And it is a 3-hour drive from Indianapolis to Chicago on even with normal Chicago traffic, you know, maybe 3.5, maybe.
Sure.
8 hours is crazy. You know, our friends at Sun King actually were part of a collaboration to brew a bunch of eclipse-related products in collaboration with a bunch of other breweries around the country. And they had a big festival downtown.
I should have hooked them up. Dave from Sun King, I know you're listening. You're one of our biggest fans. I'm sorry that I didn't get you involved with Vermont's own Four Quarters Brewery, which is a moon-based brewery. We could have had a moon-based brewery and a sun-based brewery collaborating for the solar eclipse.
James.
I feel like I don't know if it's the world, but definitely America down.
Definitely.
You know what? This might be irrecoverable.
It might be. But I think this next story is going to help us. Before we get into this next story, I got to break character for a minute. And listen, I got to address some things that have been weighing heavily on my mind lately. We have been putting out some of our most polished and well-produced segments. Honestly, at this point, we're basically indistinguishable from like a prestige podcast on NPR. But Team Cyanite, man, I'm here. I'm afraid we've lost our way. We've been talking a lot about space and engineering, dishwashers, and all that safe stuff. But I don't even think Steffi has had a nightmare all season long.
Nope.
That ends today.
No.
Today we fulfill the promise that we have made to our listeners, and we return to our roots. So a group of scientists from Brazil that were studying a worm-like amphibian called the Sicilian, and I promise you, I looked up that pronunciation. It is Sicilian. I am not the one that is making that link phonetically or culturally.
It's a C-A-E.
It is C-A-E, but it is pronounced Sicilian. I am sorry, people of Italy and New Jersey. Anyway, they discovered that these like worm-like amphibians produce milk. That is the story. We have evidence of a totally different lineage from mammals independently evolving milk. And folks, we call that convergent evolution. That's right. We're talking about convergent evolution, sort of.
Sort of.
The real question is, when will we see Sicilian milk at our local hipster coffee shops? Because I'm looking to have that alternative in my life. And The thing that Steffi doesn't know, she thinks this is just a story about how these worm-like amphibians, I cannot stress enough how they are not worms, they are amphibians. They're like froggies, not like earthworms. But the real reason that they were being kind of observed in the first place is because normally these little baby amphibians are eating the skin of the mother every 2 days for nourishment. Mm-hmm. That's right. Buried the lead in this milk thing. They're eating the skin of the mother for nourishment every 2 days. But these little baby Sicilians were so hungry that the mom also had to convergently to evolve milk.
Can I jump in here for a second? Because that, to me, was the best part of this story was the scientists who were involved in making this observation said that these little babies... baby worm-like amphibians, again, stressing that they are amphibians, had way too much energy to have gotten that just from eating the skin of their mom every couple of days. And so there must have been something that was different. So they just kept watching them, and these babies started converging around one particular part of the mom. They noticed that was one spot that they all really liked, and it was toward the tail of the mom. And then under closer observation, they noticed that it was secreting something. And so they've called it milk. While at the same time, and they called it milk because it's got like lipids in it and it's got some proteins in it, right? And so it's got different things in it, right? But then they go on to address that the FDA classifies milk as having to have calcium in it, and they don't address whether there's calcium in this at all. So they just ignore that altogether, but they call it milk. And to me, the best part of that story is that they noticed that these little babies had way too much energy for just just subsisting off of the skin of their mom.
Just the skin of their mom. So you know, Mother's Day is coming up.
There's a lot going on.
Don't forget to send your mom a card.
Right, but so this is what... The other part of the skin issue here that was interesting to me is that I guess the skin is shiny. It's very shiny. It almost sounded to me like it was, I guess, the exoskeleton of a shrimp or something, right? And maybe not quite that tough, but something like that. And the reason I say that is that... the researchers made the observation that when you hold these things in your hands, right? And I wasn't able to tell how big these are, but these are not small from what I can tell.
No. I just checked the picture. Wow.
Right. But you can feel them wiggling and moving inside their skin. So their skin is independently stationary from them wiggling inside, right? And so... that has to be, you know, part of the mechanism for how these babies are able to feed off that skin, right? Is that it's not directly attached or I should say it's not intimately attached any longer to the rest of the innards that are there, right? And other layers of skin. But to feel it wiggling inside its skin, the researcher said was weird.
How long do they eat that skin?
Exactly like those gourds you get and you dry it out and you shake the seeds inside, right?
Right.
They eat that skin every 2 days.
For how long?
For as long as it takes.
Oh, here's the best part, Steffi. They come out of mom way too early. So they need actually a lot of altricial behavior from the mother in order to keep.
I don't know what that behavior means.
James, you want to take a stab at it?
So I am not gonna make this leap and talk about humans. But we will talk about these little amphibian dudes because I don't want to burn any bridges before they're even built. Altricial behavior means that for some reason, be it some kind of evolutionary advantage or some kind of anatomical difference, the babies are coming out half-baked, basically. And that means they need a lot extra help from the mom. They can't just like be a pony, come out and walk within a couple hours. So they are completely dependent on the parents for kind of everything, right? Human babies are a lot like that. They're pretty soft when they come out, pretty squishy. The opposite would be like a pony, where you can see them kind of galloping around a couple hours after birth, right?
Yep.
Did I get that right, Jason?
Yeah, very good. So anyway, the idea here being that these babies need mom to stick around because they come out half-baked, as James put it, means that there's a lot of investment in making sure that the offspring survive, right? Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of us. So this is where the nightmare comes in, right? There are a lot of offspring because there are a bunch of babies here. And usually when that happens, there is less parental investment because they, you know, they flood the, so to speak, you know, the marketplace, so to speak, of predators, right? And that, you know, not all of their offspring will get eaten, right, by predators. And so they'll get their genes in the next generation and so on and so forth. In this case, there are a lot of babies and they're all hanging around mom and she's protecting them and they're all going to survive, or a lot of them are going to survive, meaning that there's going to be exponential growth of these things if you're not careful, Steffi, and they're going to come for you.
And just to make it even worse, Steffi, the line between amphibian and worm has never been more blurred when these little babies come out.
I just looked at the picture. Because
they are like little pink worms just squirming around the mom.
And the mom is like a giant worm thing. I know.
And I think, so I think the difference is when the little babies get around water, they turn that into spice. Right, and then the mothers will feed on the spice.
I still haven't seen Dune 2. Don't spoil it.
You mean you haven't read the book from the 70s?
No, I don't read books.
I think you need to get David J. Peterson back on here to talk about just exactly that, James.
Exactly, the life cycle of sandworms. Uh-huh. Final answer, Steffi, you gotta read Frank Herbert's Dune, but then don't watch those new movies with Timothy Chalamet and Mary Jane Parker from the new Spider-Man franchise. Watch the David Lynch version from the 80s with Sting and other people, but with Sting. And just forget this new slick one exists. Because you don't need to watch more. You don't need to watch two movies. You just need to watch the hour and 30 minutes of David Lynch making Dune. It's great. I stand by that decision. Come at me, the internet.
Do you think David Lynch, when describing the sandworms, right? Is there a name for them? Sandworms, right? I don't know.
I believe they call them the Shai Hulud.
Oh, thank you. I couldn't remember. Do you think he described them the same way that one of the lead researchers in this study described the Sicilians? Quote, they are kind of elegant, and they have a shiny body and a very nice face.
A nice face?
Yes,
I think so.
She said they have a very nice face.
That's cute.
My people say, oh, they have a nice shane upon them.
They do. They do.
A nice, shane upon them. Face. Nice.
When you, once shane you get them. Past the body horror of it all, they do have little eyes and like a little mouth. They are not 100% worm-like.
How big are they?
They, you know what they remind me of? They remind me of Beetlejuice's face on worms in Beetlejuice. Kinda. That's what they look like.
It's a nice face. Yeah.
Yes, it is a nice face. They look like Michael Keaton.
Nice face.
I don't know if David Lynch would refer to them in that way, but I do know he would exclusively drink Sicilian milk if given the opportunity, because David Lynch is that kind of guy, I think.
When I saw the headline, the first thing I thought about was Luke Skywalker drinking that blue milk from whatever that creature was.
Sure.
No.
That's what I thought.
Sure. I can't.
Yeah.
It's too late at night for this one.
Well, on that note, we're going to go to a message from a podcast I think you're going to enjoy.
So, have you ever thought about what would happen if your airline window popped out? Or if you could build a jetpack using only machine guns? Turns out you can, but you really, really shouldn't. Hi, I'm Jill Chacha, host of a podcast that's for weird people who like learning about weird stuff. It's called, well, That's Interesting, and it's a comedy science-y show that tells the story behind the facts, because those stories are funny. Every Thursday, I tell the tale behind an odd new discovery, like how researchers found two mysterious structures surrounding Earth's core, or how it's actually possible to stop hiccups using a rectal massage. Yes, there's a story behind that. No pun intended. And I tell the story because storytelling is the perfect way to learn and remember. The facts are bizarre, the stories are epic, and the laughter is plentiful. So, join the flock and listen to Well, That's Interesting wherever you do podcasts.
We're just a couple short weeks away from Fusion Energy Week, so you know we gotta turn to our favorite Fusioneer to get everyone excited. And this week, we're talking about Stellarators, because those rascals at the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab built a new one. Stellarators are similar to tokamaks, which is what Steffi has in her basement, but different. in a way that, I gotta be honest with you, I don't understand. Something about magnets. How do they work?
All right.
So that means
magic.
It's time for Dr. Deem to clear up the fusion confusion.
Dr. Deem clears up the fusion confusion.
Okay, I normally say that Stellarators look like twisty caterpillars, but after that... Ooh. Wormy story. I can't. It looks like. So instead, I'm going to say Stellarators look like you took a tokamak and you dropped it and it got all twisted.
Okay. Yeah? So still in a ring, but.
It's still in a ring. Yeah, but it's all
twisted metal.
Twisted up. There's a reason why you do that. I'll highlight just very quickly. It's cheaper and easier to build a tokamak because it's just like simpler construction. But then. With a tokamak, you have to drive current in the fuel to help make its confining magnetic field, which means that it can lead to instabilities. So what you can do is build a Stellarator where all the confining magnetic field is external through coils that have been wild and twisty. Then you don't have to worry about current instabilities, like messing things up. But that means historically it's been more expensive to engineer that, those complex shapes, right? So in recent years, we've had a lot of advances in like the manufacturing sector where you can actually like 3D print things and stuff like that. So these researchers were like, why don't we take advantage of technology and rethink how we make a Stellarator? And we're going to take a bunch of tiny little permanent magnets and install them in a different configurations and use like stuff you can buy off the shelf and 3D components to make those twisty magnetic field lines with just little tiny coils. So that's what they did. It's a smaller kind of tabletop experiment, but it's pretty fascinating. The other thing about Stellarators, I will say, is because all your magnetic fields are fixed, then that kind of fixes your magnetic field configuration. You can't really change anything. So when you're manufacturing these large twisty coils, if you have defects in the manufacturing process, that makes it imperfect. It's not as optimal as you want it to be, but with these tiny little magnets, they were showing that you can get more precision in how you're actually making those twisty magnetic field lines without the big coils.
I'm just picturing like when they came up with this idea, just Arturo, a friend of the pod, Arturo Dominguez, just walking around with a box full of like novelty magnets from a conference or something, and kind of like falling onto the model of the Stellarator, which was developed in the 70s. So they probably in their little museum area got like a little bitty Stellarator somewhere. Having all these like wish you were here magnets falling onto this model. And the Isaac Newton moment was like, wait a second. What if I put this Donald Duck magnet into the guts of the Stellarator?
They're a little bit stronger than your Donald Duck magnet.
You have no idea how strong a well-made Donald Duck magnet. I'm talking about bought from the Disney company Donald Duck magnets. I'm not talking about like what you get down on like ones. International Drive in Orlando. Yeah, this is officially licensed Donald Duck magnets. Like the color's not a little bit off. It is what Walt Disney wanted you to have. And, you know, just like Walt Disney said, if you can dream it, you can do it.
Right. Yeah. So I'll go into a little bit of the history. Is that okay? Because you mentioned the history
of
Princeton.
So Walt Disney World Resort was created.
Back in the 1950s. 1951. So the Stellarator configuration was actually started by Princeton Plasma Physics Lab. We'll say PPPL for short. In the 1950s.
Yes, we will. We always do.
Yes, right? There you go. Yeah. By Lyman Spitzer. And that was part of Project Matterhorn, which was classified.
Of course it was part of Project Matterhorn, right? While the Disneyland Resort was being created. Hey.
There you go.
I was going to let you pull us away from the Walt Disney analogy, but you keep throwing it right back
at me. It's not me, it's the government. You can blame the government. So their first place they built these was actually in a rabbit hutch because everything was top secret. You just kind of use, so the land used to, you know, be for rabbit Hutches.
It was called Fantasyland.
Right. Exactly. If you want to see some of this stuff highlighted, there's an episode of Quantum Leap, the second season for the reboot, episode 6, called Secret History. I helped with that one. But they like show some of the stuff in the history because it's based off the Stellarator and things like that. But they made several Stellarator models in the 50s before fusion research was declassified in the 1958s. So if you want to see some of those early models, they're actually in the lobby of that National Lab in New Jersey. And you can go there during Fusion Energy Week in May, because they actually have some events at that area.
What else is going on at Fusion Energy Week?
Tell us about the other things. What do you got going at Disneyland versus Disney World? Are there two different celebrations? Like, is there merch that we can market here?
It's everywhere. Can I cover one more story really quick? Like a quick highlight? Yeah. It's going to be really quick. This was also, I think, last week, the Korean superconducting tokamak advanced reactor, or K-Star for short.
Sorry, we talked about K-Star a little bit ago.
Yeah, so they just broke another record. They exceeded their previous record where they were able to heat their fuel to over 100 million degrees Celsius. And previously their record for holding onto it was 30 seconds. Now they're up to 48 seconds.
Do you think that had anything to do with like the entire attention of the world being on Korea because of that new song by the K-pop group Seraphim that is just on everybody's TikTok feed right now? We're all hearing Smarter all the time.
100%, because I think they're singing about new tungsten diverters that were installed in K-Star, right?
Yeah, you know, my Korean is not as good as it should be, so but I definitely heard tungsten diverters.
You know, that's really interesting that you say that, Steffi, because just this morning as I was riding into my office, Last Dance with Mary Jane by Tom Petty was on, and like, it got me thinking, like, is this song really about like marijuana, right? Or is it about something deeper?
Like fusion
Clearly,
energy?
It is not fusion energy, but it's interesting, like, you know, the difference between what I think about and what you think about, for example. It's just night and day. Almost like, you know, totality and not totality.
For Fusion Energy Week, you can go to Princeton Plaza Physics Lab. You can do virtual tours from a lot of places. So go to fusionenergyweek.org.
And you can also play with that thing they got on their website, right? They got that experiment that you can play with on their website.
Yep.
We'll link to that as well.
There you go.
Yeah. And you know what? First week in May, check your podcast feed, because we're going to have both of our Festivals of Fusion reissued, remastered, and re-able for fresh downloads. So check out that, and you're going to learn all kinds of the past 2 years of fusion energy that's been happening. It's very exciting. And I think that means we've come to the end of another edition of the Science Night Podcast. But don't worry, we got more coming your way. As soon as they find another weird thing that eats its mother's skin as part of its plan for survival, we're going to not shut up about that. So that means you should probably follow us on social media. I'm on X Twitter something. I'm actually not on it very much, but I do have an account, and you can find it at James_Reed3. Join me as I give up on the Sixers' hope of becoming relevant and not being in the play-in tournament, but still maintaining hope that the Philadelphia Phillies will be relevant for another couple weeks, and then we'll probably put them on the back burner as well. Steffi, where can everybody find you?
You can find me on X Twitter at Steffi Deem, where I'll be tweeting about the Phillies' favorite source of energy, fusion. And also on Instagram, fusion.deem.
I think that Philly's favorite source of energy is the cheese steak. But number two, like a very close number two, is fusion energy. Mm-hmm. Jason, where can everybody find you?
You can find me on Twitter X at OregonJM.
What will you be tweeting about in US Fusion Energy Week? Just retweeting Steffi?
Yeah,
like that's absolutely what I'm going to be doing. Right, for sure. Be way smarter, there's right?
Nothing I can contribute to that dialogue, but I can amplify it, and that's what I'll
do.
There
you go.
Yeah, please join us as we retweet Steffi, and that's about it. Well, you can follow the show at SciNightPod, which will also be retweeting Steffi during US Fusion Energy Week, but we're probably going to be retweeting some other Fusioneers as well, so at SciNightPod on Twitter X, and visit our home on the web, SciNight.com, for past episodes, the people we talk to, the stories we talk about, and of course our merch. You know there's going to be some Sicilian milk mother skin eating merch on the horizon, so just check out SciNight.com because there is so much to see, and some of it you're probably not going to want to because I'm going to get weird on the old Procreate studio. So, SciNight.com. We'll be back soon with a new episode. But until that, seriously, it eats the skin of its mother every 2 days.
And the thing is, like, lots of animals eat their mother, right? But the mother doesn't live to make more skin.
And you know those Sicilian like offspring are gonna grow up weird if that's how they're starting, right?
Right, exactly. And you know, frankly, at what point does the mom say, you know what? All I do is grow more skin for you. Can you just out of the couch?
Steffi, thank you for keeping up the kayfabe of the night. Especially the fact that I believe when you say it's too late at night and it being like 8:16 a.m. for you, like there is not a point where this is okay, is what you're saying. There is not a point in the day where this is an okay thing.
Like
we are so back.